The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Alistair Jardine, the head of product at Trint. So I was going to ask actually, whereabouts are you guys in Shoreditch? I used to actually live, well, basically in Shoreditch. It was I used to live in Hackney Square. Do you know where that is? Just down the road there.
So we're just off Brick Lane and on a place called on Hanbury Street, in a shared working space called Second Home, just out there. So yeah, it's an eclectic building for sure.
There's a lot of those kind of shared like working spaces popping up around Hackney, isn't there? I mean, obviously Hackney and Shoreditch and stuff. So you've got obviously the WeWorks and such, but there's a lot of like smaller sort of independents I've noticed that seem to be popping up around there. It's quite a popular area, really, isn't it? For it?
Yeah, it really is. We're moving in September to another space called Tech Space, which is a scale up space. Given how much we're growing at the moment, it's a necessary thing. We've grown from, when I arrived, I was employee number 22. We're now, I think, at 36, and that's in space of since October. So you kind of get the pace of change, the pace of growth is quite quick.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a fascinating product, and we'll get onto that in a little bit. But I think being a part of that, I was actually lucky enough to be a part of a couple of startups that kind of had, you know, that kind of rapid growth. And it is such a compelling environment to be in. I did constantly go through times where I definitely didn't know certain people's names, which, you know, I'm ashamed to admit. But other than that, it's typically yeah, quite exciting. And I think it's just constant challenges. You know, even the job evolves, obviously, as you kind of scale. But even within that, you know, the culture shifts, the attitude shifts, there's a lot of things to it that I think you don't necessarily account for, that are all fascinating, but certainly challenging, you know, to kind of all process, I suppose.
Oh, that is so true. Like, my background is, I joined Trint in October as lead UX. They had reached a point of sort of getting to, lots of things were changing, and there needed to be a harmonized approach to the user experience design. I also filled in for a product role for a little while, also hunting for a head of product, and ultimately it felt like the right fit. So our CEO, who I'll talk about in a little bit, it was sort of, you know, very comfortable me doing the role, so it moved into a sort of more product focused role here at Trint. So for a fair while I was doing product lead and or head of product, and also lead UX, which is quite a lot of work in a startup where there's a lot of work. So it was a bit of a challenging role for quite some time, trying to keep on top of both the strategic long-term planning, and also sort of the day-to-day, do a sketch, do a wireframe, work out the interaction design, what's this thing, how do we build it. So that was it was great. It was very satisfying, but it's very difficult to maintain. It's very difficult to maintain that clarity of thought when you're having to do two roles at the same time. Everything suffers effectively. So we built out the product team, and now we are the product team is now myself. We have lead UX Susan, lead interaction / visual designer Luke, and junior designer, a guy called NK. And we're now starting to get through that process hump, and sort of with that number of people involved, all of a sudden as you're alluding to, talking to more people and trying to get more people on board with process change, and then, but also whilst trying to deliver a product at the same time, it's interesting, it's challenging, it's good fun, and when you crack it, you get a great sense of reward. But there's certainly the direction we're going in is great, and that's what pleases me the most. Like every day we're refining that process and making it crisper and cleaner and more transparent for people, which is really good.
It's an interesting one, the kind of the product role or the product role in general. You know, I've worked with a few like product team leads and such. And actually, interestingly enough, I don't know whether this is unique to my experience. It's definitely a question that I did want to ask you, is whether there are those consistencies with people coming from typically a UX background. Because my experience was actually that a couple of the guys I worked with weren't from that kind of UX. They're actually from different backgrounds. So, you know, am I wrong to think that there are kind of various roads into becoming kind of a head of product?
Yeah, for sure. I've worked with a lot of product people in the past, and they've come from, oh gosh, a variety. So I was at The Guardian for a while, and I've worked with product people who've come from an MBA background. I've worked with them who've come from an editorial background and various places in between. And it's always really interesting to see the variety of approaches that product people take. And I think there's a really interesting set of skills that product people can have. So on the one hand, if you're working with a really technical product and you're working with a really heavily regulated area, that necessitates a different style of product manager and a different type of person to pick up that work, in my opinion, than somebody who's working in a much more creative, not to say the technical stuff isn't creative, but a sort of a startup like ourselves, if it was a very heavily technical, very strong technical product manager, I think they would miss the nuance of dealing with customers potentially on a daily basis. So, as I say, my background is user experience, so I value the user's voice extremely strongly in the decisions that I make. I don't value it less or more strongly than the strategic direction that the company needs to go in. But obviously, it's really important that we're nailing the user experience, and it's really important that we're effectively enabling people to do their jobs on our platform. I remember working with a product manager at The Guardian, a guy called David, whose background had been building editorial systems for journalists. He'd been doing it for a long time, and he was absolutely brilliant. The perspective he brought, because of his ability to work closely with journalists and have those conversations, and he had the trust, and I think that's a really important thing, having the trust of your users to deliver the right thing, and enables you to sort of take a few chances, sort of go, okay, we could try this, let's see what happens. And like having that trust with your user base is to me quite important, and showing that if we make mistakes, we fix them quickly as well. That's an element of building that trust. But yeah, waffly random answer, yes, there's lots of people who come into product management, and there's no real single direction in, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. I think it's such a cool role. I think it's relatively new as well, you know, whether we just kind of framed it in a different way, but it's certainly not been around for that long to the extent that it is now. But the, you know, the product that you guys are kind of building over at Trint, just to give context that, if you would, like a little bit about that, because for me it seems like it's quite close to you know, working with obviously the voice technology that seems to be having a little bit of a mini boom at the moment. A lot of people, a lot of investors are being quite bullish on that tech at the moment.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, so give a bit of context. So Trint came about from our CEO seeing a demo of speech to text technology, and in the context of transcription. So Jeff Kaufman, our CEO, is a now ex news reporter. He's worked for ABC News, large media organizations, and so he's seen it. He's had to he's lived the pain, so to speak, of transcribing interviews. And so anything to take that pain away is a massive thing. It's a big boost to both productivity and also just enjoyment of work. He saw this demo and was like, there's a product in there. He was really excited about it. And so in, I think it was December 2014, they started work. They launched in September 2016 and has been growing since then, really. So our product effectively takes spoken word. So let's say an interview a journalist is performing. We transcribe that from speech into text, and our editor allows you to play back and also edit mistranscribed words into the correct word really easily, because we're gluing the audio to the text. Unlike if you send a file to a third-party service, and you might get the transcription back, but it's still very challenging to correct it. Our USP is really the smoothness from which you can get to a polished, perfect transcript. And yeah, it's certainly nascent. I mean, I think Trint was the first sort of service offering this. Obviously, now the competitive landscape is very different from when we first launched. So yeah, there seem to be competitors nipping at our heels all the time, which is quite exciting.
The thing that I'm sure is quite fascinating as well is this seems as though this tech is evolving as you guys build as well. It's almost that, you know, you're right at the front of the queue with regards to being in the space. But it seems like the tech is just getting better and better. You know, it's got to be, I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, it coincides with things like, you know, the skills stores and things like that, where people are, you know, they're just pure like audio. But it's essentially leveraging that technology, right? And it seems as though that technology is getting better like by the quarter at the moment. So, you know, it seems like from a product perspective as well, you have to kind of be on your toes and keep your ear to the ground so you know, like, you know, what, you know, even more. I mean, a lot of people in technology have to be that way anyway, but it seems as though you kind of have to be on a kind of a next level with that regard.
Yeah, it is evolving so quickly, and you see so many competitors popping up based on really interesting services, like the Amazon services, for example. Amazon speech to text engines, Google has one. There's loads of players out there. You could spin up a service very quickly. I think where it becomes more challenging is sort of really understanding people's workflows. So that's ultimately speech to text is becoming commoditized. There's no doubt about it. When Amazon is starting to play in the space and Google, you know that the service just becomes easier to get hold of, and the barrier of entry lowers. What we're really focused in on ultimately is that workflow piece. Like, how can we make our podcasters more effective? How can we make journalists? How can we reduce their turnaround time from getting in an interview, a State of the Union, for example, from the words that come out of a president's mouth into a live transcript that appears on a news website? So we're really focused in on sort of the transcription is really important to us, but we're also very, very mindful that there's a whole bunch of workflow either side of the transcription process that we need to be aware of. And I think that's where we're really trying to add the value. The transcription is a starting point for us and not the end goal, if that makes sense. The transcription technology is moving so quickly though, and we have to be on it. And there are so many third-party services out there that we could integrate with as well. And it's just trying to work out which of those opportunities are the right ones to jump on for our users, and which ones add value to their workflows. I mean, you should see the size of our idea backlog. It's quite scary, and almost we have sort of many ideas that come in every day from our users that I either are new or we've heard before. But it is interesting when people start to think about that. It comes back down to accuracy. A lot of people want more accuracy because they want to spend less time doing that polishing to perfect. We're certainly doing a few things in that space to help that process. But it's also about working with the words and media itself, where we're in a bit of a grey area between a text editor and not a text editor as well. So it's interesting. Lots of interesting product decisions to make about where we take our editing experience. in the future.
And I suppose the benefit of it as well, you know, in true to the UX roots, is the research element, because there probably is so much excitement around the space and the product itself. It's probably fantastic that you, I'm sure, get so much feedback from your users. So it probably, you know, that's probably hence why the backlog's so long. But that's got to be incredibly beneficial to have that excitement and have that feedback loop, so that, you know, you can really leverage, you know, not just the intelligence inside the organization, but everyone, all the stakeholders that are even using the product as well.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like, we have our users are so engaged. And that is absolutely fantastic. So when I arrived, you just start reading through the feedback, and you know, you get the standard range of feedback. It's like, oh, it hasn't done a very good job, to, oh my God, this has transformed my life. And when you start hearing that, you think, okay, that's what you want to hear. You've got a product that genuinely saves people time and they enjoy using it. Like, that is absolutely fantastic. And so we have our idea backlog is hundreds and hundreds of items long, and we could pick off any one of them and I know it would deliver some value to the users. I mean, our feedback loop is pretty tight. We have feedback coming in from our support people. We have various forums. I speak to a couple of customers every week at least. My Susan, our lead UX, is doing usability tests with customers, 3 or 4 customers a week as well. So not huge volumes of direct outreach, but whenever I go, hey, I want to speak to someone about our mobile app, I've had 20 responses back within 24 hours, and that is great. And if you're trying to do discovery work on where you could take something, being able to speak to 20 people, if you take half an hour, that's still solid 10 hours worth of chatting to customers about stuff. And that level of engagement is fantastic. And granted, they're engaged customers. They're the people you want, you know, the people that are going to often give you a positive answer, but they're also the people you're trying to keep as customers and trying to maintain as well. We are in a space that is now extremely competitive. We have competitors who are keeping us on our toes, but if we engage with our customers that like us, then we're building things for them. We're trying to solve their workflow problems. Our process is very customer focused. So we capture everything, every idea that a customer has, we capture, and then we just start adding weight to it. If we hear it twice, we add it to the same idea and build that kind of weight of argument up to say, actually, we should pick this feature off. The trick I have is balancing that with the strategic priorities that we want to get to as a company, which don't always, there are some things we want to do that users wouldn't necessarily ask for, which I can't really talk about, but it's about finding the time to schedule the work in to do the things that the customers want and the things that we want to do. And that's the trick of sort of a product person.
When you started off kind of seeking out, and I'm sure you were kind of engaged with the product itself, but as someone who has to be, you know, lead up the product team, I think it's quite an obvious thing, this, but maybe I'm wrong, that you have to be bought into the product itself as the kind of product lead. So, you know, in that process, you know, we spoke a little bit about it earlier, of seeking out opportunities, was it kind of a conscious effort to get into the space because you kind of had that genuine interest? And you know, from your perspective, is it still really important to have a genuine interest and motivation for the product that you're kind of working on? And again, it probably sounds like a bit of a layman question, but the irony is that it's probably really not.
Look, it's actually a great question. I'll give you a bit of background about how I got here in sort of this product role. So I was at The Guardian for 5 years, and I spent probably a good 2.5-3 of those as the sort of UX person on the tools team. So The Guardian was rebuilding their content management system. And I came into it and I was sort of signed into it, kind of thinking, oh, this, not so sure this is going to be quite good fun, because obviously the Guardian's website is like a lot of fun. There's a lot of really interesting stuff to do in the product there. I was like, okay, I'll give this tools thing a go, and absolutely loved it. Just the thing that was so much fun was the fact that all your users are pretty much within a 30-second walk in the building. And so you have an idea, you can validate that really, really quickly. You can do a sketch with them, you can walk through a prototype. And I loved it. And what was so great about that was we were coming into a point where the Guardian was doing a big digital transformation. And I was working with this group product manager, David, and we were looking at ways to improve people's workflow. And we knew we had to work out how we were going to do that. And so we built a tool called Workflow that was deeply unimaginative, but it solved genuine problems. And we spent a year iterating on this product. And every single time we were doing something, it was making people's lives better. And we could see the changes happening in the newsroom. We could see the engagement we were getting because of that rapid cycle of delivery, actually solving users' problems. And it made me so passionate about that. And I kind of wanted to carry on working in that space. So I kind of did a bit of the product management of some of the tools at the Guardian with David, and sort of held my own, sort of doing a couple of other things. We built a quiz building tool as well, and a few other bits and bobs. Started looking into machine learning and content suggestion as well from a tooling perspective, and it was great. I had a fantastic time, and I was looking for other opportunities, and I saw one at Springer Nature, which is a large science publisher, working on their submission process. So again, sort of content ingestion, content management, and then working away there. And then I saw this opportunity at Trin and was like, wow, okay, that was it looks fantastic. Jeff is extremely dynamic. His personality is amazing. His powers of persuasion are second to none. And as soon as I went into the interview to talk about Trent and what they were trying to do and where they wanted to get to, I just knew it. I'd used the product before the interview, and like, it was clear that it solved a massive problem for people. And as soon as you kind of go, okay, this is so interesting, and I think hopefully my talking about it, my passion for solving these types of problems is there, and I think it sustains you through the challenging moments where you're juggling 20 things up in the air at the same time, and you're kind of going, okay, no, this is going to make people's lives better. And you know, it also enables customers to actually find that the richness of an interview. It gives them the opportunity to find that killer quote that will sort of make their careers, or the killer quote that makes the story. And before, it's a bit of a muddy process. Now it's really exciting. Anyway, that's me rambling on about why passion is important. But ultimately, the passion will sustain you through the good times and the bad. And I've always found that. As well,
so. I totally agree, mate. I totally agree. I think it's one of those things that I think it's probably easier. It's clearly easier said than done, and I know that I've said these things in the past, and you know, it's not. You know, I think what it is that people can tend to look maybe for their idea of passion. I think when you think about it in a kind of a practical sense, or you think about it in like just from a conscious sense. You may not think of the things that you actually become passionate about, because it may not be the product, it may be, you know, the systems, it may be the process, it may be, you know, the logistics and the team and the culture, whatever the part of the process is that your work's involved in. That's what you need to identify that you know, feel strongly about. You know, it might be that the product itself isn't what keeps you motivated, but it's, you know, the team dynamics and you know, working towards the changing of a culture, for instance. And I think what I've had in the past is people say to me, well, you know, I've heard you talking about that previously, and well, surely the jobs and the products that a lot of people feel passionately about are typically popular. Therefore, you know, it's probably highly competitive to get that particular role. So you can therefore feel passionate about it. And I think that I acknowledge that, and I think there's probably an element of truth in that. But again, I think to clear things up, like, it is important, you know, if you're working on a tech that you probably are working with a particular tech stack that, you know, you feel passionately about or whatever. But it can be, the passion can be about the process, it can be about the team, it can be about the product itself, obviously. And I think the ethos of the organization as well, you clearly have to be bought into. So it goes a bit deeper than I think people give it credit for. And I just wanted to kind of add that in as an additional thing so that people, you know, don't come at me again about saying, you know, that you need to work for something that you're passionate about and, you know, it can be highly competitive. So there's truth in that. Yeah. But I think it's what you're doing on a daily basis. And, you know, it's not always about the product, although it definitely helps.
Yeah, and it certainly does. We're so conscious of our culture as well. So it's a really, really big part of our hiring process. We have such a great team of people here, and I think genuinely would be delighted to spend time with them outside of the work context, and that's genuinely really hard to find. Like, usually it's not the case in teams, but actually it's a fantastic bunch of people, and that's one of the passions as well. It's building that team. Like, I'm really passionate about getting the product discovery process, like, really tight, really well done, absolutely assuring that what we build is validated, and where it isn't, going away and sort of reworking it, and that product development process, getting that sorted, is another thing that I'm deeply keen on nailing here at Trint. When we're not there yet, I'll be the first person to say that, but we've definitely taken steps towards it, and we couldn't change it overnight. You have to take people on a journey, but we're on that journey now, and that's, again, nail the things that you enjoy doing well, and actually that will show through as well, and people will hopefully follow your lead on that. So,
and it's the only way to kind of, I suppose, from a company's perspective as well, or even from kind of a team lead's perspective, where, you know, you do have to worry about churn a lot these days, you know, of staff. It's so important that they're bought into it, because, like you say, these long-term projects, they don't happen overnight. You need to have consistency built in for, you know, a number of years, right, to really fully execute on a long-term vision. So, you know, you have to ensure that, I think, you make that effort to let people know about all aspects of working there, the product, the culture, and all that is so, so important, especially in today's age, because, you know, it's very acceptable to move about after a year or so. That's not a big deal, and I kind of agree with that, you know, especially within tech. But you know, on the contrary, as a company, they have to do their best to retain the talent, and this is all part of that retention strategy as well, is to have that kind of transparency, I suppose, on everything that we've kind of just mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think Jeff, our founder, is extremely transparent with the team. And it's fantastic. So he communicates so clearly. I suppose that's his broadcast journalism background enables him to be an excellent communicator. But his clarity of communication just means that everybody knows where everything is at in terms of the company. And all employees have a stake in the company as well. So we are a startup. Everyone has some equity. It makes sense. It gets people pointing in the right direction, so you can have a genuine conversation, which is this the right thing for the company? Is this the right thing for our users? And it removes a lot of the cruft as well. So when you have everyone pointing to a single goal, whether you're motivated by making people's lives better or building a big company, it helps immensely. And so it allows people to sort of carry on pushing in the right direction.
Agreed, mate. Agreed. I'm conscious of time here, so I think we'll kind of shut it down. I think we covered a lot of the points, because I think if I get going again, we'll do another 30 maybe 60 minutes.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.